Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where things are going and what we think the future is going to be like. And we're not afraid to take kind of a contrarian view. Our view is that if you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
Well, I'm a little wiped, a little tired from my kind of busy week on the road, but feeling good, feeling glad to be back home. How about you?
I'm doing great. I am not at home. I'm in San Antonio this week and having a vacation with the family and having a great time. But if I sound a little different, it's because I actually used Skype to call in tonight. So hopefully that'll work out fine.
You're calling in on Skype. Now, we've experimented with podcasting in the early days, did some podcasting with Skype, and found it less than completely satisfactory in fact, weren't we using Skype? Am I crazy? Or weren't we using Skype when we talked to Aubrey de Grey?
We sure were, and it worked out pretty good, except that, you know, it seemed like we were having a lot of echo problems, and especially when we tried to record and everything. So anyway, by the way, we got Michael on the line as well. He just joined us, I believe. Is that you, Michael?
It is. I have a nasty, stupid cold that's still going, and I just woke up.
Okay.
Summer colds, well, they're the worst.
Well, Michael, we appreciate you watching the chat room for us, and joining us even through the cold.
Now, are you asleep? Are you asleep because of the cold or because of the antihistamines?
There's something equivalent to the Fifth Amendment where you don't have to really confess your stupidity, and that's me now.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. I think, I understand. Because I've been known to do, like, you know, shooters of NyQuil, right? Get a little salt on the rim and kind of get that going, little lime after the fact. But, it doesn't always put you where you want to be. But that's fine because, you know what, you're in the chat room. And if you need to be slow in responding in the chat room, everyone will just think it's the server.
That's right.
I declined to comment.
Hey, fair enough. And it took him a minute to say that, too.
I noticed that we have, in addition to Michael Darling in the chat room, we've got Matt Doing, and Harvey's there as well, I believe.
All right. Well, welcome to all our chatters. And I guess that can take us pretty much to our first. Oh, wait. Before we get to our first order of business, I want to check in on movies, because I don't think we discussed any movies last week. Is that right, or did we? I'm a little shaky on what happened.
I have not seen a movie this week with all the traveling and everything, so I guess I'm a little poor on that. But one thing I have watched video-wise here lately is the opening ceremony of the Olympics, which was completely
awesome. Okay,
well,
before we go there, because we want to come back around by way of the coffee mug, I think, to that. But I did go to a movie, one of the big summer releases, Mamma Mia. Okay, so
add that one
to the list of great summer movies. Right, this is the summer of all the great summer movies. This one, you know, I don't think you had mentioned it earlier, Stephen. I don't think you had said, hey, plus we got the film version of Mamma Mia coming out. So, you know,
no, I guess I had somehow I'd failed to mention that one.
Quite an oversight on your part.
True, as well as the fact that we finally get to find out what James Bond sounds like singing.
Boy, and let me tell you, not worth the wait. You know what's funny about that is I was listening to one of these like Entertainment This Week shows this morning, and they were talking about that. I guess he did some movie. Oh gosh, I can't remember the name of it now. Like back in the 80s, where he was singing, and it was a complete bomb. And he came on the air later. They played this video clip from him, audio clip from him saying, Pierce Brosnan, we're talking about, I should note.
Yeah.
I will never subject the public to that again. You will never have to worry about hearing me sing again. And so they play that clip in connection with the fact that he's now in Mamma Mia. And and the announcer guy said, well, Pierce, all we can say is about your singing, as a singer, you make a great James Bond, okay? That's all we can say about that.
Oh,
yeah, he's about as good as I am, okay? If you saw that video clip of me that was up on the Speculist, anyone who saw that, I would put him up there at about that level. That's where Pierce Brosnan is as a singer. However, since we're on the subject, yeah, you know, just in all seriousness, probably not the kind of movie we normally talk about, Mamma Mia, but I did go see it, so I thought I'd throw it in, since, you know, we've talked about chimps and space and stuff, although that, I guess, arguably has more of a speculist angle than Mamma Mia does. In fact, if you hadn't mentioned James Bond, I don't see how there was any connection for this movie at all. But what I was going to say was, you know, unless you're a huge ABBA fan, okay?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Or you're like a woman, okay, or like, you know, married to a woman or something. This is not a movie I would have picked on my own, I think, probably, to go see. I guess that's my point.
That's fair enough. I've found myself in a number of movies that I would not have gone to on my own. And you know,
as a married man, you find yourself in that situation frequently. Let's face it.
And sometimes as a father too. But
as a father, right? Yeah.
But either way, you're making points. Sometimes as a father, sometimes as a husband, by going to movies that you wouldn't necessarily go to. So
it's all for the points. I'll just say that one thing. You know, I totally forgot about some of those ABBA songs. You know, they start singing some of these songs, and it takes you back like 30 years, you know, go, geez, yeah, I sort of vaguely remember that song. So that was kind of interesting. And the other thing is, as bad as Pierce Brosnan was, you know, he's not that bad. I mean, you know, as less than thrilling as he was, Meryl Streep has got a heck of a set of pipes on her. She really carried a lot of that movie with her.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I don't know. Sometimes you can kind of guess by speaking voice whether a person could sing or not. But
yeah, she's just an incredibly talented person. Could have been a diva, I think. Could have been a Barbara Streisand or something had she chosen to. Glad she didn't. Glad she chose the career path she did. But again, we've got the, you know, someday we'll peek into alternate universes and see the world where Meryl Streep was in fact a big diva. And now I've brought it around to speculative material. We've always got the parallel universe thing to fall back on. Okay, so let's talk about our coffee mug competition, and I'm now calling this the Solve All the World's Problems, Win a Coffee Mug competition that we were running over the last 2 weeks, and that was in connection with our show where we were talking about not all the world's problems, but how we could solve some of the major problems facing the world, and we had asked our listeners to contribute their ideas via the chat, via calling in, and and I believe we also got comments left on the blog. So we've been talking it over. We got lots of good commentary, both live on the show as well as after the fact, and I think we have gone through it all and decided on a winner.
That's right. We got a winner, and we were unanimous in our voting on this, and I'll let you announce it.
We were unanimous, and not to take anything away from anyone else's contribution, but I think with the best, most straightforward idea for how to solve all the world's problems, the coffee mug goes to Harvey for his desalinization ideas. So, Harvey, congratulations on solving the world's problems, and we have now, you know, to motivate you further in solving more problems for the world, we will give you this. It's kind of like it's like a mini Nobel, I would think of it as kind of.
Very many, but yeah. Take it,
you know,
and do well.
Yeah, you know, I see we're getting the big yeah out there. Okay, so congratulations. And for everyone else, we'll run more of these, so keep trying. Keep putting out your great ideas. Also, these mugs are now available for sale for anyone, which they don't do with Nobel, by the way.
Yeah, you can't buy a Nobel.
Yeah, this is kind of an advantage we have over the Nobel is you can actually buy one of ours. So yeah, I think we'll run that every now and then. I like the idea that, you know, we can provide a little incentive for people to solve the problems of the world. You know, just doing our part. We'll throw a coffee mug your way, maybe a T-shirt at some point to anyone who's got great ideas. But the desalinization idea is an excellent idea. It addresses a number of things at once. It addresses poverty. It addresses hunger. And we talked about the relationship between those and violence and just general technological and economic development. It's a great idea, and it's one that that we're hoping to see implemented in the very near future.
No doubt.
So, where is that?
I want to just backtrack real quick and say I posted some pictures of San Antonio, and trying to get this put in the chat. Let's see if I can get that. All right, yeah, cool. Anybody want to see two or three pictures of San Antonio as of this afternoon? Just click that link there, and it'll be in the show notes too, of course.
Yeah, this is kind of the. We don't take any time off during the year on Fast Forward Radio, but I would say this is kind of the more relaxed part of the year, right? We're not lining up a lot of guests. We're putting links in the chat room to share our vacation photos, that kind of thing. You know, it's that time of year, I think. So,
obviously, Michael Darling hasn't ever heard the phrase "Remember the Alamo." He's asking, "What's in San Antonio?"
Well, for one thing, the Alamo.
They've taken the river that flows through the city and developed the whole thing in such a way. It's incredible. It's called the Riverwalk, and you know, it's like 3 or 4 miles within the city where they shops and everything else are right there down on the water. It's incredible, and check out the pictures I sent. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Well, Michael claims now that he knew about the Alamo and the Riverwalk.
Okay. All right.
The question is, why are you hanging there? I believe it's family vacation, right?
That's right. Yeah, just having some fun, and it's not a far drive from where I live. So sometimes it's just good to get
away. You know, they got the big Six Flags there. They got the big water park there. Here we are throwing a little advertising San Antonio's way. If anyone's listening down there, Chamber of Commerce or whatever, yes, we are available. This show can be sponsored. Give us a call.
Schlitterbahn and everything else down here. Yep.
Exactly right. Now, we were going to talk about the Olympics, and I think that was the thing you mentioned rather than watching a movie that you had seen lately. But before we get into that, let me just say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil and Stephen talking about various topics in the future and how to make it a better future. And if you'd like to join our discussion, you can join us in our chat room or give us a call at 347-215-8972. So let's talk a little bit about the opening ceremonies for the Olympics. And this, for me, begins as kind of a follow-up to all my video travails that I've been sharing my stories about this week, because I was flying back from Las Vegas on Friday and would not make it home on time to watch the opening ceremonies, and my DVR has broken down on me. It's one of those, like, it's satellite, so the little card that you stick in there that makes it work has fritzed out. So they're sending me another card, but in the meantime, I got no DVR, so I wasn't able to record the opening ceremonies at the time or any of the subsequent broadcasts. So I've kind of missed them, but I'm guessing, Michael, did you get a chance to see him?
It's a strange thing. I watched, but I couldn't hear. And you say, well, what the heck happened? In the Denver metro area, the local broadcast had pretty good video, except no HD, and the audio was lost for about 70%.
Oh, wow.
So if you DVR'd it, you would have DVR'd the primetime broadcast, and you wouldn't have got it anyway, because you would have had no audio. You'd be like, what? My DVR screwed up. No, the local broadcast had no audio.
That would have been very bogus. Okay.
I ended up watching most of it on the web.
okay.
It was incredible, wasn't it, Michael?
It was something.
I tell you, there's never been an opening ceremony for the Olympics. China's got a lot to be proud of after that opening ceremony. But of course, the lighting of the torch at the very end is the thing that everybody will remember from now on. It's wire foo taken to the ultimate limit, you know.
Okay,
just to describe it. Okay, they bring in all these various Chinese athletic heroes. Okay, and they round the stadium, and each gets about a fourth of the stadium and passes it off to the next hero, and then the last one. I forget what his significance was. I think he may have been a gold medal winner back during the when China finally came back to the Olympics back in '84. But anyway, he takes the torch, and these wires lift him to the top of the stadium, and then he does this pantomime run that looks so realistic. It looked like he was running in space. All around the stadium, he went around the entire stadium, and surrounding him, going behind him, was the screen, which has got to be the largest television screen ever made, which covered the entire 360 of this huge stadium, and showed images of athletic images behind him and sort of a wave pattern in front of him. And then, I mean, when he finally got to the end, when he finally completely surrounded this, done his run all the way around the place, he lit the torch and it went, spiraling upwards and boom into flames. And then, of course, fireworks go off all throughout Beijing. It was absolutely incredible. I have never seen such a spectacle in all my life. And that was on television. You can only imagine what it would have been like had you actually been there.
Right.
Just incredible, and China is really, I think they're using the occasion of the Olympics to announce their arrival, really, as, China's been a big deal for a long time, but I think that they're saying that we're a really, really big deal now, so.
Yeah, well, we kind of talked about this a little bit over the last couple of weeks. I mean, this is China's opportunity to declare themselves to the whole world, with the whole world listening, that they have arrived and that they are not only a player on the world stage, but one of the top players on the world stage, and that they are to be taken seriously. I mean, that's kind of the message, that just kind of go China, huh? I mean, that's what they've been able to put out via the Olympics. And we were talking with Will Brown a little bit about this last week. The Olympics is a much nicer way of doing that than maybe a century ago a country would have had. That option maybe wouldn't have been available. If you wanted to really make yourself a player on the world stage, about the only way to do it would have been to build a huge army and go attack somebody. But now China's doing it, economically and by, developing socially and through a lot of different ways. But this is kind of the big way of announcing it and the big way of saying, here we are, we've arrived, we're China, get used to it, kind of thing.
That's right.
Do you get that feeling from what you saw in the ceremony?
Oh, absolutely. How about you, Michael?
I did. Maybe a little less... American in your face, we're here, we're us, kind of thing. But no denying that I don't think anybody else would have approached either the scripting or the choreography, the architecture. Everything looked and felt very Beijing or very China. I mean, I've never been to China, but by all accounts, it was a pretty accurate expression of the national, hey, we're going to do the Olympics our way.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, I just want to note, since it's being noted in the chat room, that we are on the 30-day countdown for CERN, and Stephen, let's make a note that we'll get into CERN at some point over the next 30 days, or maybe once that, David Ray points out, biggest single science experiment in human history gets going. Yes, Michael, that's right. There were no big CERN opening ceremonies. but CERN's about to announce itself to the world stage in a very big way, in a very different way. And it's something I think that that we're going to have to be talking about a little bit. We've talked a little bit about it on the Speculist, but haven't spent too much time talking about it on the program. So maybe we'll spend some time on that over the next few weeks.
Well, you know, when we get visitors from the future, when they arrive, because you know, the particle accelerator has been switched on, then that certainly will be a big deal, huh?
Yeah, well, we'll be creating our end of the time machine, and so they can come back to us, right? Or as Michael points out, creating an alternate universe where Meryl Streep was a diva rather than an actress. See how it all ties together in a very nice way. I think in addition to all that fun stuff, there's some major significant major significance to what's happening, and we're going to have to spend some time on that. But let's talk a little bit about how this opening ceremony for the Olympics relates to the idea of the robust golden rule. You had written a really neat post earlier this week on the subject of the golden rule. And talk us through that and explain to us how China fits in.
Okay, my idea in this post was that it's an old idea of mine that, you know, cynics will often say that, you know, might makes right. You know, if you're powerful enough, then you get to set the rules, and that makes you right and all that. But I think that more often, though, being right creates might. And a good example of this is the creation of the Internet and how that worked. Really the backbone of the Internet has sort of a principle behind it that be conservative in what you do. This is a robust principle. It's a principle called the robust principle, or also Postel's law. It's be conservative in what you do, be liberal in what you accept from others. And the idea there is that when you're writing the software or whatever for a router or whatever, that you make sure that what you send out can be read by everybody, but then you try to write the receiving end of the software to be able to accept everybody. And so you, by being conservative in how you send information out, but very liberal in how you accept information that comes in, you end up being able to pass off information very well, and that has created the robustness of the Internet. But the openness of the Internet goes beyond that, in the sense that it was not a closed system like, say, CompuServe or Prodigy, or what were some of the other ones in the early days?
I was on a service called Delphi.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
There were a number of others. Yeah.
Absolutely. But those have sort of gone by the wayside.
Right.
And I think the reason for that is another principle, that the value of a telecommunication network is proportional basically to the size, the number of connections. And so if you're completely open, then you're going to grow faster and therefore become the default standard, basically, and the other systems basically dropped out then.
Explain to me, just so we get it, how is the Internet more forgiving is it conservative going out and liberal coming in than, say, CompuServe was?
Well, in order to be a part of the CompuServe network, you had to, you had to pay money to CompuServe, and you were part of then the CompuServe network, or Delphi or any of these other networks, but they didn't talk with one another. And
right.
I guess the Internet got an early boost. Because a lot of these other systems would attempt to use the Internet, once it got big enough. But, if you were on the Internet, you could talk to everybody else that was on the Internet. But CompuServe, these were these small companies. And that you would tend to have to log in, and a lot of times there were dial-in numbers that were long distance and things like that. It just didn't work as well.
Right.
I, I don't know that I'm explaining it well enough. You probably have a
well, but I think the bottom line is it the internet is a completely open system. It's an open set of standards. So if you hook into that network, you're just hooked in. Yeah, there's
right.
No fees to pay. There's you're still paying for the electricity and the whatever that networking access is or something like that. But something like CompuServe was like an overlay on top of existing infrastructure, and most people were using phone dial up for that. So limiting access was its driving principle, as opposed
right.
to the internet, where opening access is the driving principle. Is that a fair way to break that down?
That is fair, and that also brings us to how this ties in with China.
Okay.
China wants to be a big deal, and I'm excited for them to be a big deal. I'd like for China to be a big deal, but I think that the ultimate way for them to, you know, really step onto the world stage, if that's what they want to do, is they need to open themselves up. They need to stop being afraid of the freedom of their people. They need to have open elections. They need, you know, and I'm not necessarily saying they need to be America, you know, all over again. They need to be China, but they need to allow more freedom for their people. And to the extent that China has been able to step onto the world stage in the last few years is because they've allowed more freedom. But they need to continue that process and keep it moving forward. I had a really good comment in that post that I was writing about the robust golden rule, and basically it was saying that, you know, the ruling, the powers to be, the reason it hasn't happened is the powers to be are don't want to lose their privileged status, and I completely agree. But there's a process they could go through. They could build for themselves golden parachutes and still keep the process moving forward. You know, they could. You know,
there's a whole problem about how you transition out of a strictly authoritarian government. And here's an interesting let's do a little parallel comparison here on the geopolitical stage. Look at China's neighbor Russia, who managed to successfully cast off the communist system, provided economic freedom to their people, then to a certain extent actual social, civil, political freedom to their people, and then stepped sharply away from that. I think everybody would have to agree at this point that they have moved distinctly away from that, and their behavior.
This is a particularly bad week for them right now.
Exactly. Well, it's a worse week for Georgia, I would say. But they have stepped sharply away from that and kind of moved in the other direction. And in fact, when you think about making a big play on the world stage, how interesting to compare the big play that China's making on the world stage with its hosting of the Olympics and its, you know, this is kind of its debut party, right, out into the world of the 21st century. Compare what, you know, its actions on the world stage with its neighbor Russia's actions on the world stage. So I think, you know, one of the things that you want to make sure happens is that as things are opened up, that they really are opened up, and that at some point you've got the kind of infrastructure that you need to keep things moving in the right direction, that you get to where you have true rule of law, which I don't think, having spent a significant amount of time in Russia in the early mid 90s, I don't think they got to that point. And I think that's what, you know, they gobbled up the idea of the market economy, but they didn't really embrace the idea of political freedom. They didn't really embrace the idea of a non-corrupt civil society. And so what you have now is, you know, kind of reversion to the authoritarian state. And, you know, just a real unfortunate state of affairs. So you look at China and you say, yeah, they really need to open up. But you would certainly not want to see it go in this direction, right? I mean, that would be just the worst thing of all.
Right, right. You know, if rushing to open up leads to something like what's happened in Russia, then by all means, take your time. You know, but, yeah, one hopes that they'll continue to move forward and you know, step onto the world stage by opening up and not allowing their people to travel would be a nice step, and you know, more than they are allowed to now, and having elections of some sort. That, I think, you know, there's much that they could do to open up, and so I hope that they'll continue to do so.
Just get rid of that whole bureaucracy of people enforcing restrictions on Google, right?
Yeah.
enforcing restrictions on the internet. I mean, just let it go, right? When they start letting some of that stuff go, I think things are going to be moving in the right direction. I note that in the chat room, OK David Ray says that there's an interesting contrast between the debuts of Russia and China. Both countries have a groundswell of nationalist support for their particular displays, in the case of China with the Olympics, in the case of Russia with their military display, and that's true. The Russian people are very much behind the shift to authoritarianism, and I think it's important to note that there has been a lot of popular support for that. But the tone is very different, and I think that in the case of Russia, authoritarianism starts to look pretty good after, you know, you give people enough chaos for long enough, and somebody who can come in and straighten things out and make you feel good about your country starts to look pretty good. And I think that probably that has a lot to do with Putin's popularity there. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about various topics related to the future, talking a little bit about the Golden Rule. We've got some other topics we'll be getting into a little bit later, but if you'd like to join us, if you have a comment on any of these subjects, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972. Join us on the air, or you can join us in our live chat. Either way, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So where does that leave us with the Golden Rule? Do we see this as kind of an evolutionary optima for human civilization? Do we think it's inevitable that human society will evolve around open systems? Or is it something that we have to struggle for and it could go either way? What's your prediction of the future?
Well, it's not inevitable, as Russia shows us, you know. You can always fall backwards. But the thing is, I believe that openness and doing the right thing and, you know, the whole, becoming an open society leads to strengths that cannot be duplicated with a dictatorship. They said about Mussolini that, you know, at least he had the trains running on time, you know.
Right, right.
You know, but you couldn't go anywhere. So why were you? if you couldn't get on the train and take the train to, you know, Switzerland, then what's the point of the train being on time? So, you know, I guess openness is more powerful in the long run. It's just if you got people in charge that want to guard their power and their privileged status, then it may be hard to step away from that.
Yeah, I think so. And Mussolini makes a great cautionary tale too, doesn't he? Because here's a guy who had all that popular support, Il Dolce, beloved leader of his country, and you know what happened to him in the end, right? So, running the trains on time, you know, only got him so far, I'm afraid, with the Italian people. And in the end, it did not end well for him. Nor do I expect it to end well for, and I'm not talking about individuals, but any systems that exploit their own people. Because I think, if not inevitable, it is at least optimal. And that if evolution is allowed to continue in its proper direction, in the direction that we've been moving towards, yes, there can be setbacks, but the actual direction forward is towards openness, and that I think we're, inexorably, slowly, painfully, and with a lot of stumbling, moving towards one global open society. And there are pitfalls, and it doesn't have to happen that way. And, you know, we could slide back for 1,000 or 10,000 years into something truly dismal. But I believe that's actually assuming that we can continue to progress at all, that's the end game, and that's where progress will ultimately take us.
I think that it's safe to say that the world is far more open today than it was 100 years ago.
Exactly.
And it seems to be the direction of history at this point. So, yeah, I'm optimistic as well.
and was more open 100 years ago than it was 500 years before that.
That's right.
So I think the trend has been in the right direction. Although if you look at the middle part of the 20th century, you would say the world's a lot less open than it was 100 years ago, or you might be inclined to say that. So it's certainly not something where we can sit back and go, well, the world's going to be free, therefore, you know, let's have some good cookies or something.
Yeah,
I mean,
therefore, good people can do nothing. It doesn't work like that. Yeah.
Right. No, it obviously requires all of us working together to make that happen, to have those memes, to have those ideas come out on top. And I think the reason that they can succeed even in the face of great hardship and great opposition is that they bring so much power with them. Just as you were talking about, you know, the internet was right brings might. You do this thing right, you open something completely up, everybody joins it, and suddenly it is absolutely essential. It's indispensable. Everybody has to have it. It's something that we can't even imagine doing without. I think that China has probably found that to be the case with an open free market economy, which they made this amazing transition from a planned centrally planned communist economy to what we see today over a period of, what, 25 years? Not even. 15 years,
yeah,
I don't know.
And now that the genie's out of the bottle, you know, I don't know that they could shove that back in.
Yeah, so. I don't think they'd want to. You know, that's the bottom line. And the only thing that might lead them to would be if the idea of accompanying that with political freedom, accompanying that with actually letting the people have the same kind of freedom that we enjoy in the West was perceived as such a threat that it seemed like it was worth it to sacrifice the one for the other. And I don't think they'd make that choice. I think they're too smart for that. So that's my vote of confidence for the Chinese.
Absolutely.
Okay, so did we cover that golden rule adequately, Stephen? I had just sort of read over it, and I wanted to make sure that we covered that topic correctly.
I believe that we have, Phil. I think that, you know, the point is that, you know, because the internet, I think that I was using the internet there as a picture of how openness ruled over the other competing systems, and how I hope that that's the path that China ultimately uses. So yeah, I think the point's been made.
Okay, all right. Well, because I could keep talking in circles around it all night, but we've got a couple other things that we want to get to. Michael, were there any other thoughts from our chat room on that subject?
Matt made a good point that I think in looking at Russia, any shift back towards less openness and more authoritarian regime or more central planning, if you will, might feel natural for the people that grew up in that. As long as you don't go too far back, I would add to that.
Right. Yeah. I think there's an older generation there that that definitely probably does seem like a familiar, very comfortable thing where, you know, back in Soviet days, you at least knew where your paycheck wasn't much, but you at least knew where it was coming from. And I think there's an aspect of that, an aspect of a younger generation who've known nothing but just kind of crazy chaos this whole time. And, if they've got a strong national leader that they feel like they can take pride in, then – you know, why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they invest in that? It comes back to the idea we talked a little bit about last week about how many options are available to you, and China has made a lot more options available to its people. Russia made some more options available to its people, but it's the options that maybe people have that they don't realize they have that might be. That might be holding them back. So yeah, I think it's going to be kind of a long, hard road for Russia. But I hope not. I hope they can turn things around and get back on track. Well, I'm going to shift gears now, and we're going to talk about something completely different. We're going to take a little journey into the unknown with a little feature that we run once in a while, a little something that we like to call.
Paranormal.
I didn't know if I wound up to that one enough or not, Stephen. I guess I did. That's pretty good. I've got a fun one tonight for Tales of the Paranormal because I was torn, as I have been with a couple of these lately, whether I should make this a Tales of the Paranormal or an Astounding Science Facts. And this is something that lies, I think, somewhere south of Astounding Science Facts. But if we get more evidence, if we get more information on it and it starts to pan out, it could actually push us in that direction. And if it does, it will be a truly astounding science fact. And I refer to an email on Jerry Pornell's website on the subject of precognition. And I'm just going to go ahead and read it. It's not that long. Mr. Pornell, yesterday I saw a cable TV show on mental abilities. The person was trying to figure out how a good fighter pilot was better than a poor fighter pilot, even when we both had the same level of training. He had a brainstorm and thought, is it possible that the good pilots can see a short distance into the future? Kind of like the movie Next, but only a few seconds. So how to test for this? His test process was as follows. He had a random slideshow of both emotional pictures, babies, angry dogs, etc., and non-emotional pictures, like random patterns or a smooth lake shore, generated by a computer. So the person would view the pictures when connected to a lie detector, and he then plotted the responses. Skin conduction and stuff, I guess pulse and all that stuff that that they check on a polygraph for the emotional responses that the pictures drew from the people looking at them. And what did you say? So for the emotion, the non-emotional pictures on a graph versus time. Okay, so you're looking at somebody sees an emotional picture, it spikes, and the next one's emotional, it stays up there. The next one's emotional, it stays up there. The next one's really boring. And it goes down. So we track this curve of the responses that people had to these pictures. Now, here's what's interesting. He did this again and again for each subject. As expected, the two average curves over many pictures were very different, with the emotional pictures causing many stronger changes to the test point results than the bland pictures. The thing he found very strange was, for at least some subjects, while the two curves lay essentially right on top of each other at the start and for several seconds into the test prior to the time of the picture being displayed, the divergence between the curves started a few seconds prior to the picture of the given type being shown, which is another way of saying some people were having their emotional spike or their emotional calm down a little too early based on the picture they were currently looking at. The subjects already knew that the coming picture was bland or emotional in a way that was impossible unless they could see into the future a few seconds. It's possible that the picture mix wasn't random enough and some pattern existed, but this can be eliminated by never repeating a picture and randomly loading the picture file using some random number generator and then scrambling them again and again using different methods each time so that even the tester cannot possibly guess what is coming up each time. The tester in this case was not even in the room while the tests were going on to keep any bias from getting into the results. If this works with ace fighter pilots, too, then no wonder they usually beat anyone else. Now, this is a rather simple test and could be done with virtually anybody, so I would hope that somebody else would either verify or refute his results soon. And then it's signed. So this is really interesting. And Jerry Pornell responds. He finds it interesting. He ends it by saying, if I had to bet, I'd bet against confirmation of any precognition, but I would not bet the farm. So I'm going to actually turn this initially over to Michael, because, Michael, you're closer to fighter pilots than the rest of us. You've had some experience in that area. Do you think that there could be something to this?
Yes, and not just because of that experience, although it's hard to separate my ideas and understanding of how we sort of do anything anymore from that experience in my life. But let me just say this, that at any given point, whatever we're doing is all essentially, although at very, very small increments, already done. We're already reacting to what's already happened. And so to the degree that we do anything, we do it, at the very sort of bleeding or leading edge of the time arrow that we're on, we do it right at the future or even into it. So to think that intuitively, instinctively, cognitively, somebody is slightly better at that, maybe slightly further ahead, I have absolutely no problem with. In fact, I was a navigator, and one of the things that you both teach, and I was later a navigator instructor, but one of the things that you teach and have to learn in the navigation universe in fighter aircraft is that you are thinking in front of where the jet is, so that what's under you right now really doesn't matter all that much unless it's shooting at you, and that's a different equation. But in terms of flying the jet, if you're not thinking out ahead of the jet already, you're lost.
So
yeah, that's
so
right.
You have to be making predictions as you go anyway.
But when you're driving a car. It's just the difference is that when you're cruising the freeway at 60 miles an hour, it's a slightly different exercise than when you're flying a jet at 600 miles an hour.
Right.
Right.
You know, Stephen, what this reminds me of is we've talked a little bit about that book On Intelligence, I think, in the past.
Right.
And the author, his name escapes me, but he talks about how basically everything that we think of as intelligence is about prediction, that our probably our whole experience of consciousness is just this mental process of trying to predict what we're going to sense. When we all of our motion-based intelligence is trying to predict where an object will be, where our foot's going to land, all those kinds of things. So I'm gonna put this question to you. Do you think it's possible that prediction being the key driver to intelligence, that we as a species have evolved the ability to see slightly into the future, or some of us have?
Well, I don't think that there's anything paranormal about this. I think what we're looking at is we've got a situation where our brains, actually the chemical basis of our brains and everything is actually a slow computer, okay?
Right.
And so in order to interact with the present, we actually, our brains have to think a second or two ahead. And what I mean by that is our brains are guessing. They're making we're making intelligent guesses all the time as to what the present is like, you know, from the past. Basically, is the way that's working. And some brains are gonna be better at that than other brains. And I guess the brains that are the best at it get to be ace fighter pilots. And maybe they're NASCAR drivers or something. But you know, the better you are at it, the better you're going to be able to act within the present. And there's also a lot of what we do and what, you know, the people that come across as really witty in conversations and things like that, a lot of it has been pre-thought out. They already have stock answers to situations already pre-thought out, so that when and they may not even be thinking about this consciously. This is, you know, maybe all happening within the subconscious, but it's there, and they're able to access it quickly to come across as a great wit in conversation.
Yeah, I personally have about 6 jokes that I use, so I have to keep making new friends because.
I think you've got more than that. You got plenty of ideas. We haven't reached the bottom.
Okay, well, maybe I got 5 jokes, but this is Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about precognition, but you might have known I was going to say that. If you'd like to join our discussion, you can call us at 347-215-8972. Okay, but let's stick with that for a moment, because you know Michael's talking in the chat room about being able to see, what was it, 30 seconds in front of the plane, which is a pretty good distance, knowing what's going to happen there. But it's
sort of like a good chess player can see perhaps further, more moves into the future, in a game than somebody that's a poor chess player.
So what you're saying is that that in this particular test there must have been some pattern, and these people have just picked up the pattern.
Yes, I do not think anything.
They are responding before the picture shows up, right? I mean, this is
right.
You know, it's not. To me, that would indicate something other than just, you know, a good chess player who knows what the other guy's move is going to be, right? I mean, this is somebody who you would think, having just spent the week in Las Vegas, could go make a fortune on craps. Right, because you know, if you could actually see just a few seconds into the future, you'd know what the dice were going to be, and you'd know how to you'd know how to place your bets and so forth. But so you're taking the scientific high road here. suggesting that without more evidence, we're not going to think that there's anything
paranormal taking.
I'm continuum here. Yeah.
Right, right. I'm with Jerry Pournelle. I doubt that they'll find that the precognition is taking place, but I'm not going to bet the farm. I'm with him on that.
Okay. Question from Michael. Aren't there some who do make a fortune on craps, or is that all a myth? Michael, I actually have a system I could share with you, so you know we can talk. We can talk. Actually, that's a good question. I don't know that anybody does reliably. You know, you can, because blackjack or some of those other games, you know, there's a way to get an edge. I don't. A game like roulette or craps, there's always a house edge, unless you had some paranormal power or some inside information about the dice being loaded, the table being at a funny angle. In the case of roulette, the wheel favoring a certain section. You hear about those kinds of things. But assuming everything perfect, there's no way a person could be a consistent winner in those games unless they had something like this. But I don't know that I've ever heard of anyone who was. So if you are one of those people, give us a call. We'd love to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
So I think then we're agreed that this is fascinating, but we're not ready to take the leap into full blown precognition yet.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I'd like to see more evidence on this, and it is very intriguing. If this were to pan out, it would certainly give us a new way to look at the world. Well, we've got one other topic that we want to touch briefly on tonight. I don't know if you saw the link on InstaPundit to a piece by Dr. Robert Zubrin, who has been a guest on this program, talking about his book Energy Victory, and talking about his plan for using flex fuels to get the U.S. off foreign oil and basically make ourselves much more energy self-sufficient. He had a response to the T. Boone Pickens wind and natural gas plan that we talked about. I think it was probably about 3 weeks ago we made mention of that. Did you happen to see that piece?
I sure did. And Zubrin was complimentary to T. Boone Pickens, saying that, you know, he sees the problem. He sees that, you know, basically what we're sending out is so much that foreign powers, particularly OPEC, could buy this country in a few years, and that's obviously strategically a problem for this country. And Zubrin agrees and says that T. Boone Pickens is being a real patriot, coming out and pointing out this problem. But then he goes on to disagree in the details, and we shouldn't really be surprised with the plan that Zubrin comes out with. It was the very same plan that he presented to us here on Fast Forward Radio.
Right. Well, in fact, I thought it was pretty interesting. You know, Zubrin looks at T. Boone Pickens' plan to let's catch wind, in the middle part of the country, and then we'll use the natural gas to power cars. And Zubrin looks at that plan and goes, you know what would be a better idea than that? Flex fuels. No huge surprise that it comes back to that. But one of the points he raises is that, hey, if you want to, I mean, he's not saying you can't get a lot of energy out of wind, although I don't know that he's persuaded by T. Boone Pickens' assessment of how much energy we'd get out of wind. But his real point is take that natural gas, that methane, and turn it into methanol, make it a liquid fuel that will then burn in an existing gas tank rather than have it be this compressed gas that's very heavy, that adds a lot of infrastructure, that's very expensive. And I was pretty much convinced by that argument. It seems to me that that's a good way to go. And it raises the question, we keep talking about flex fuels, petroleum, ethanol, and methanol all running in the same vehicle. Is anyone doing anything with methanol? Is there any plan to start producing it? Because we could be producing it out of coal. There's a lot of different ways we could be getting it, but you don't hear much of anything being done with that.
No, you don't. And I don't know if that's because it's just not being reported and it's happening all over the place, or if nothing's being done at all. I guess we should try to check in on that. But I mean, I like what Zubrin says there. I think Zubrin has a good point, although it may be the same point he's made to us before and we've heard before. But He's pointing out that natural gas is not necessarily the best fuel for powering cars. You have to have a compressed gas tank, which is very, very heavy. It's not an ideal fuel to transport. Liquid fuels are just so much better for that purpose. And plus, we've only got maybe a 10-year supply of natural gas in this country, and we've got hundreds of years of supply of methanol by way of coal. And so, yeah, I'm hearing him, and seems to me he's got a point. Although wind power is not a bad thing either. So maybe if everybody gets their way, and Zubrin gets his flex fuel cars, and T-Boone Pickens gets his wind power, then and plus we get nuclear power and everything else, and we move also towards more hybrid vehicles, more electric vehicles, then all of these things could be part of the solution. And, I've called electric the ultimate flex fuel because you can make, electric power from any energy source. So, if a flex fuel hybrid, why couldn't that work? So
that seems to be the kind of direction we need to go. I mean, we're evolving towards the electric car, which, as you point out, is the ultimate flex fuel vehicle, because anything you can make electricity out of, you can then power that electric car with. Opening up the options for what you burn in a internal combustion engine along the way just seems like the smart and sensible way to go. And I really have to say that it seems
since
to be
it call, and it only costs. I'm sorry, Phil. I'm sorry. Since it costs $100.
Go ahead. No, you. I'm really.
since it only costs $100 to do it, that's another reason why it's such a smart idea.
I was going to say the same thing. It costs $1,000 to convert a car over to natural gas, and then it only burns on natural gas. But if you take that natural gas, turn it into methanol, burn it in a flex fuel car, you can burn ethanol, you can burn methanol, you can burn gasoline. It seems like, that's just a nice little tweak, a nice little improvement on Mr. Pickens' plan, and it feels to me like the two would work very well together. Now, I want to just quickly point out that we got an interesting link in the chat room related to, I don't know if it's precognition or not because I haven't had a chance to read it, but we'll be sure to include this in the show notes. This is from OK David Ray, and the story is about, the headline is Northrop Scoops DARPA Mind Reader Helmet Threat Visor Cache. For one thing, that sounds kind of like one of those James Taranto headlines where he puts, someone set up us the bomb. You ever see that in Best of the Web where he... Maybe not.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I can't scan that headline and make it make sense. But apparently, there is some research going on into something close to, if not precognition, at least enhancing our systems to be able to deal with the immediate future a little bit better than we have. So we'll want to be sure and include that. Thank you for that link. That's right up our alley. See, that one is. That one would be, I think, an astounding science fact if we were to talk about that one on the show. So,
well, let's just play it.
Okay.
Astounding science facts.
That seemed a little on the loud side, but that was. I think maybe the. Now we know what the downside is to using the less expensive phone system. Oh, we get the really loud astounding science facts. So that's cool. So we got both features in tonight. Thanks for that link. We'll be sure and include that in the show notes. So what do we got going on music wise tonight, Stephen?
Well, we've got a fun, with apologies to this is not a politically correct song at all. It's a brief history of pudding. Is the name of the song, and it's by Jeff McGoogle, and it reminds me to, if you like the Bare Naked Ladies, the group called Bare Naked Ladies, you're going to love this song. And it's an explanation as to why we don't have a unified theory in physics, and I find it as compelling as any reason I've heard before as to why we don't have it. And anyway, here's the song. I hope you like it.
So let me just double check. Okay, so this is a Bare Naked Ladies like song called "The History of Pudding" that explains why we don't have a once again theory of everything kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Unified theory in physics and the
unified
and the
theory
of the song,
physics. Thanks. And it's politically incorrect to boot. Right.
Yeah, it's a brief history of pudding. So, you can guess as to who it might be about.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to listening to that. Thanks for that. Thanks to our listeners, both in the chat room and elsewhere. We appreciate your comments. We appreciate you being with us, and we'll look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Soaking in your sponge bath, you ponder all the things that make up our existence here and all the joy it brings. But before you reach your unifying theory, you get distracted by a snack.
Delicious pudding.
It makes you dum 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 dum, that yummy pudding. It's like the Big Bang in your mouth, like a black hole on your brain, like vacationing in Maine. Just one taste, your intellect goes south. Top it off with Cool Whip, man, this stuff will be your doom. And before you can complete your brilliant thesis, you're off the chair and lying on your back.
Give me my pudding.
It makes you dum 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 dum, that yummy pudding. It's like the Big Bang in your mouth, like a black hole on your brain, like vacationing in Maine. Just one taste, your intellect goes south.
Give me some of that sweet nectar.
And if you could hold a spoon, I'd say drop it. There's a monkey on your back. Okay, side pocket. Let's try a different path. Come on, Steve, do the math.
Bakewell's awesome.
Now maybe we could help you if we knew just what it was that put you on this treat, just what was the first cause. But before you share your story in a nutshell, just seems to me you really don't know Jack.
Yummy pudding.
It makes you dum 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 dum, that yummy pudding. It's like the Big Bang in your mouth, like a black hole on your brain, like vacationing in Maine. Just one taste, your intellect goes south.
One more time.
It makes you dum 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 dum, that yummy pudding. It's like the Big Bang in your mouth, like a black hole on your brain, like vacationing in Maine. Just one taste, your intellect goes south.
Pudding plus Stephen Hawking equals true love.